welcome to Season 7, Episode 7 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Wednesday, the 14th of May, I think.
It is.
And we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, hello. You can send us messages using the chat thing on the website and the hash UUPCIRC channel on Freenode. I'm Alan. And joining me this week are Tony.
Hi, Alan.
Hello. Laura.
Hiya.
Good. Mark.
Hello.
Hello. How are we all?
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. Enjoying some cake from before, that was nice.
Oh, it's really sweet. Thank you to Laura's mum for the cake. That was really, really yummy.
Yeah, it's well-travelled, that cake.
Is there any more of it?
No, but I'll make some more.
Yay.
Excellent.
Super. Should we get on with it?
Yeah, let's crack on with the news.
Sounds okay.
Like a cake-packed show.
And here are the news. First up, we have a report that the Digital Economy Act, the thing that we all sat and watched MPs talk about in the small hours of the morning in 2010, they have been announced, the piracy combating measures. Basically, a big powwow took place between the ISPs and the motion picture people in the UK and the British recording industry, and they decided the best approach to stop piracy was a series of sternly worded letters.
Oh, was this the thing that was going to be three strikes and your internet connection is shut down and you're in internet poverty forever?
Yes.
Yeah, potentially. Basically, when the Act went through originally, there was a clause saying, we'll sort these details out later. They'll be by negotiation and Ofcom are going to be involved and things. But the industries have got to get up together and the outcome seems to be...
It's a stupid idea.
Well,
which is the stupid idea? The one where they send you three letters and then kick you off the internet forever? Or the one where they send you letters... All of them.
They disabling and limiting internet access. The ISPs didn't like it.
Yeah,
right. Nor did the customers.
Well, yeah, but who? Where did they get a say in this?
Right, but if you abuse something, surely you should be prevented from making that thing worse for everyone else. Let's use the usual car analogy. If I am being stupid in a car, like, for example, drinking and driving...
Yes, endangering people's lives, carry on. I can see how this analogy fits. Go on.
Yeah, but I make the world worse
by
doing that, so I get prevented from doing that.
So next time you're drinking and internet surfing...
Every day. Every day.
I'd like to see that.
No, you don't.
Well,
I have to put a post-it note over the webcam.
I was going to say, thanks to GCHQ, we can all enjoy that site.
So you can't see the Nuki Brown I'm drinking.
You think that's the only camera?
Well, yes. Yeah.
But yeah, so this is quite interesting after, 4 years and nearly the entire Parliament. Because it was one of the last things that was discussed under the old Labour government.
Yeah, about half an hour before the government was dissolved.
It's to see it finally actually kind of being, well, this isn't even the implementation, this is a proposal for the implementation. So, something will follow maybe by 2018. Those letters will be,
So fine. Download all your Game of Thrones episodes now before 2018.
Otherwise, you'll get a letter telling you that you can subscribe to something and watch them legally.
Right.
I think that's the idea.
And give me a copy while you're at it as well.
Says Alan Pope.
That's Alan.
Pretty sure you don't get a letter just for suggesting other people should do it. That's not on the bill, is it?
Isn't that inciting crime?
Inciting copyright.
No, I don't know. I didn't say illegally download.
But they said pass it to you.
What makes it worse was I heard somebody else say the same thing the other day, and he's clearly just copied them.
Oh, see what you did there.
Right, what's up on the next news item, Laura?
The Navina open source laptop has raised $314,000 in a successful crowdfunding campaign, and there's still four days left to go as we record, which is what last week if you're watching this next week.
Oh, here we go again. What was the target?
I have no idea. $250,000,
I think.
And he's got... 50% more than he asked for. So this is for an open laptop, as in open firmware and open hardware and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
quite literally open hardware, in that you can take the case apart and I don't know.
Well, one of the models is bizarrely the screen is kind of flat when it's shut, and then when you lift it, the screen is facing outwards. Yeah. So when you lift it up. It's kind of imagine a laptop round the wrong way, like facing someone else, but all the guts are showing to someone else.
Yeah.
Bizarrely.
And then you have to plug a external keyboard in.
Yes, it's a kind of bizarre design, but you know, it's the kind of thing that the hackery types might be okay with.
It's a portable computer, really, rather than an actual laptop in the traditional sense.
And one of the top perks is a wooden one.
Yeah, that wooden one is a proper laptop. Yes. Albeit made of wood.
Looks a bit like an old ThinkPad when it's like a really old ThinkPad.
Yeah, they're using ThinkPad keyboards, aren't they? Yeah, it's actually a ThinkPad keyboard because it's got the touch point in the middle, which makes me drool over it a little bit. Yeah.
So is it fair to say that this is a proof of concept and that if they carry on making them, they'll get more like an actual laptop in time?
I mean, the schematics are all completely open, so people could... I mean, one of the things you can get is just the board, so you could get the board and create something around that board which is like a proper laptop, use the schematics to make your own and, you know, go into business with these open source laptops if you wanted.
Oh, right.
If one wanted, yes.
I think part of the appeal is that it is... hackable. It's like the Raspberry Pi didn't come in a lovely designed case with you know, all the connectors presented on one end, and you know, but that didn't stop people buying it in droves. I think there's something to be said for, you know, being slightly unconventional in a hardware sense. I know there are people out there who, you know, wouldn't want to buy something that was arguably ugly.
Yeah, it's kind of the hipster approach, isn't it? People carrying around a
like
laptop.
Like fixie bikes, yeah.
The size of a house, yeah, just because it's cool.
What sort of specs is it?
I start carrying a CRT monitor around just because it's...
There are photos of that all over the internet of people taking, yeah, stupid computers to Starbucks.
Taking an iMac and popping it on the
table. I'm sure we'll very soon see people carrying these things.
Yes.
1.2 gigahertz.
Of what?
Processor.
Right. And it's ARM as well. It's not x86, which is interesting.
1.2 gig quad-core ARM processor with 4 gig of RAM and a 4 gig micro SD card in the base model, although some of the posher models have SSD drives and things in it.
Right. I'm more impressed now. I wasn't so impressed with the 1.2 gigahertz.
Yeah.
That's probably comparable with your tablet, I would think.
Yeah,
performance-wise.
Being an ARM processor, it's suited to that sort of thing. Yeah. So that makes an interesting question about what you can put on it, because there isn't, for example, currently an ARM port of Ubuntu. Yes, well, there is, but can you just download it and put it on something?
Yeah, we've had ARM port for years.
Have you?
Yeah.
Was it available?
Yeah.
Okay.
But yes, it comes running Debian.
Right, okay.
So I guess that's booting from the microSD.
Why are you
looking
at me like that? As if ARM is something.
I think because when you go to the download page for Ubuntu, you don't see a big button saying here's the download for ARM.
No, because there generally isn't a single unified download. You have to port it to specific hardware because it doesn't have like ACPI for detecting hardware like PCs do. So ARM boards generally have to have a bespoke kernel with the drivers and stuff.
Okay.
So, it is there. Ports.ubuntu.com is where you go, I think.
Right, okay.
All right.
Anyway, so it comes with Debian.
Yes.
Which is obviously a lot easier.
Yes.
That's like Ubuntu.
What? Easier?
Well, because it comes with Debian.
Okay.
It's on the
SD card.
Yeah.
In the same way that Raspberry Pi comes with an SD card. Right, okay.
Exactly. It's there.
If it works with Debian, it must work with Ubuntu. That's a good thing.
It's grumpy trousers on. Isn't the odd numbered episodes? Everyone's got a bit of a thing.
It's like it's easier to use Android on your Nexus phone because it comes with Android than it is to put Ubuntu Touch on it.
Yeah, it doesn't come with an SD card that you put in your phone and boot from.
No.
I think everybody's had too much cake.
The screen, it doesn't like separate from the battery and like expose all the innards on your Android phone. There are differences between these.
Can I get...
back to the point?
Right.
Can I get an SD card with Ubuntu on for this thing?
For that thing,
yeah,
if you asked Alan nicely,
probably at some point, yeah. No
oh,
doubt.
At some point, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Not
well, given the thing doesn't exist yet, it's somewhat difficult.
I've seen a photo.
Okay,
it's made of wood.
Mark, save us from this.
The European Court of Human Justice, European Union Court of Justice, in fact, has decreed that people have the right to be forgotten on the internet. I think that was probably happening already in some cases. A case brought by a man who didn't like an auction notice for his repossessed home appearing in Google search results has set a precedent. What precedent has he set exactly?
That you should be able to erase your past, on your online past.
Right. So what, you can say to Google, remove everything you've got about
it? Well, I think this is wider than just Google. I mean, they were the people in this action, but it's wider than that. You know, we as a sysadmin... on a box that has a mailing list on it. I've had emails from people asking if we can remove certain emails from the archive, or can you scrub this out? And the reasons are various. You know, sometimes we've had people say, oh, I accidentally sent a mail from my work address and it's got my phone number on the bottom of it.
Yeah.
I was like, well, you know, big wow, every mail I've sent for the last 5 years has had my phone number on it and nobody ever phones me. That's not a prompt for people to phone me. but, you know...
Alan puts hand on pocket container.
Yeah,
phone.
I'm just going to turn my phone off. But other reasons as well. Like, we've had emails from people who've said, you know, our son died and there is some conversation that he's had on a mailing list, and in order to preserve his memory, we'd like you to rub it out, you know, his good name or something. Yeah, we'd like you to rub out.
Because he had a stop some point.
But yes, or something. And so the reasons why you might want to have your past, your digital past erased, you know, can be numerous.
And you change your opinions. I mean, if you think, like, in the history of Logradio, Axe views changed.
No, he's been consistent for years and years and years, haven't you, Stuart?
Yes.
He still says things like no compromise, no compromise
whatsoever.
So I can see why people might want to do this. I think it places it's an onerous thing for other people to have to deal with when one person goes on a crusade to get rid of themselves online.
But maybe that's because it's not been designed into stuff. Everybody assumes that you can't erase your past, so they don't count it. Whereas if there were a button to just erase this person's past, and that was part of the original design of Facebook or whatever.
Yeah, but we don't, as human nature, we don't tend to factor in forward thinking. We never, like 100 years ago, we never thought about recycling, you know. So, you know, things were made out of materials that weren't easily recyclable. We don't, human nature, we don't tend to think forward, especially like kids online now, you know, posting pictures of themselves and posting photographs of their credit card and all kinds of like stuff that you just think, well, that's dumb, you know, through the gift of experience that we have.
But I agree, but my point is that we could do that now we've started thinking about it, like anything.
Well, yeah, it's retrofitting on something that was not designed
for
it.
Or new software.
There's one thing, if a teenager posts their credit card details online, and everybody can agree that's stupid and doesn't actually harm the world by that information no longer being out there. But for example, if somebody says, a political candidate says some particularly obnoxious things in an interview, and then 5 years later, you know, has modified their position and become more mainstream, they shouldn't be able to go back and tell the news paper website that I did that interview to take that interview down and hide the quotes that they said.
I agree. And that's, you know, that kind of thing is ripe for political satirists to go back and say, well, you know, your views now are inconsistent with your views in the past. And I think it's good that kind of, you know, I think there should be some kind of guidelines on what is a good reason for having your digital past removed and what's not. But I don't want to be the person who says what is and isn't the right thing to do there.
And it's also one thing to be able to modify this through search engines and search engine results, and another thing to be able to talk to individual website masters, web hosts.
And it also breaks the internet in some ways. Like, again, if you go back to the mailing list or forums, if someone was very prolific on a mailing list or on a forum and then decided one day, for whatever reason, to have their digital past removed, whether you can surgically remove each of the posts that person ever made, and then you've got the problem that there are quoted replies that other people have said. So do you surgically remove the quoted reply, or do you just blank it out? How do you censor that kind of stuff? That's a full-time job just for one mailing list, you know, for people who want to go crazy and, you know, remove themselves.
But then the precedent here wasn't about that. This was a guy who had his house repossessed, and it was for the online auction of it, which isn't necessarily stuff that you... I can understand why you'd be a bit upset about it appearing 10 years later.
But different people get upset by different things. Yeah. So, you know, you could argue that he was unreasonably upset by it because the fact is it was repossessed. Yeah. So, you know, tough, get over it.
Hmm.
Or you could argue the opposite. Moving on. MIT have released the source code for their Flash-based development tool, Scratch 2.0.
Ooh.
It's on GitHub.
Cool. What Scratch?
So Scratch, there was a Scratch 1.0, which was written in Smalltalk, I think, maybe.
I don't know why you're looking at me.
Right. No, I don't know why I'm looking at you. I thought you might know that. You know everything. So it was, and it was a desktop application. It ran on Linux, Windows, and Mac, and was open source.
Was it a cat?
There is Felix the Cat is one of the characters, and it's used by Code Club and other programming tutorials for, you know, getting kids interested in programming. It's a drag and drop thing. But then a few years ago, MIT were rewrote it and made Scratch 2.0 and updated it, and it was a web-based thing, but they wrote it in Flash. So that was
the whole forward-thinking thing again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've mentioned this in the past, and it kind of annoyed me that they were in Flash, but they've open sourced it. So, you know, maybe someone will port it to something else, you know, like HTML5 or something like that. Get on that.
Yeah. Good stuff. And in security news, it's been a vulnerability found in the PTY layer, which is the sort of virtual terminal layery thing of the Linux kernel. It's been around since version 2.6. Been around a while, basically, and has been fixed, and patches have been released. So if you care about local root exploits, Mr. Mark Johnson.
Not a sysadmin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, that was...
There's a kernel exploit. Oh,
right. Kernel exploit, but the thing is, you update your machine and it's all gone away, so don't worry about it.
Shall we quickly get on to Tony's gaming news with 7, 6 seconds left?
Well, I can't really cover it in 6 seconds.
I think you have to try.
I think we might have to stretch it so that you can give us the full gaming news.
We know you've researched this thoroughly, come on.
It's your own time you're wasting. I like to be very strict on the timings of this show, as you know. And... the longer that you there talking pointlessly, the less time I have to talk about the gaming news.
And you've already run over, so you may as well carry on.
So Unreal Engine developers, Epic Games, have announced that the next Unreal tournament will be developed as an open collaboration with a community of modders.
I never knew that's how it was pronounced. Yeah, what, is that the real pronunciation?
It's Spanish.
Unreal.
Unreal. It's Spanish. Okay. All discussion about the game will happen in the open, and progress updates will be given by live demos on Twitch, which is the live gameplay streaming site. Code and content will be available to developers on GitHub, which is sort of the big code collaboration site thing. That open
What's
source
your
developers.
Idea on there?
That's where he goes into the bit he doesn't know much about. He knows loads about gaming, but he doesn't know much about GitHub.
And the finished game will feature an online shop for contents and mods, although rockers might have to wait a little bit longer.
Hey!
With revenue to be shared between developers and Epic.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's really exciting for those Unreal Tournament fans.
Yeah, I wish we had more time to discuss that, but we don't.
Sadly, we don't, do we? Oh, well.
That's the end of the news.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If there's something you think we should talk about or someone we should talk to, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And remember, if we don't hear from you, we might not have enough content. And that can only mean one thing, more quizzes.
And instead of more quizzes, we've got some community news.
Hurrah.
Hurrah. So manufacturers of quiet computers and custom machined cases, Tranquil PC.
Is that how you pronounce that? Right.
Tranquil PC have teamed up with Canonical to make a cloud in a box. Is that still a... No, anyway. It's called the Orange Box. It's basically 10 servers in a swanky metal case designed to allow people to easily build and test cloud applications.
Yeah. Pretty awesome. I saw this in the office a couple of months ago, and everyone was crowding around it because they had the lid off this thing, this big orange box, and we're all peering in. Oh, what's that? And yeah, it was very exciting, and we couldn't say anything.
Is a cloud in a box not just a computer?
it's multiple computers. That would be a server.
It's a cluster.
This is multiple computers in a box with a gigabit switch and a Wi-Fi connectivity. So the idea is you could ask Canonical to come in and bring one into your office if you had a project that you needed to develop in the cloud. Uh-huh. But you wanted to avoid all
but
the bureaucracy.
Not in the cloud.
Well, no, but if you don't know if it's a proof of concept or maybe a training session, you don't want
like
to spin
David's
up an entire cloud
wiki.
And then go, oh, no, we don't want that. So bring it in, and Canonical do a couple of days of training, and you get to keep the box for a couple of weeks to prototype and develop and train on, and then you can move up to big boy clouds.
So what's the benefit of doing that rather than just buying a little bit of space on something like Amazon?
So often in corporate environments, I believe the experience is that you get stuck in a lot of bureaucracy trying to provision servers or acquire services from Amazon or HP or whatever, and also that then means that the data that you're dealing with is on somebody else's machine.
Right.
Whereas this is an orange box sat on your desk, so and you know exactly where the data is. Private
project.
Yeah, it's a private cloud, basically. Private cloud in a big orange box.
Without needing your own data center.
Yes. Right. Okay. But you can also buy them. So Tranquil PC actually sell them.
How big is this big orange box?
It's this big.
It's quite big.
Yeah. See, I was expecting it to be like a meter by a meter sort of big, but not that big.
Well, I did have to get up for that. No, it's about meter.
Okay.
No, it's not. It's less than that. It's like, I don't know, that by that.
Yeah, by a yard.
Yeah.
A rack-mounted server chassis?
No, it's not. It's a ruggedized case. The really cool thing is it's got only one fan for the power supply, and the inside, the 10 Intel NUX, the little tiny computers from Intel, are attached to the outside of the case, and so they dissipate the heat through the aluminium case.
Sure, it's quite cool. So it's not super noisy.
Yeah, but doesn't look like a dustbin.
Yeah,
it looks really nice.
Can you stick stickers on it?
You probably could. Yeah, I would imagine there's plenty of space for them.
Tranquil PC made the home server that I have, and that does the same thing. The motherboard's mounted on the back of the metal case, and it cools through convection or radiation.
It's pretty cool. Dustin Kirkland's posted a blog post. We'll put the link in the show notes. Yeah, it's really good.
Excellent.
The Ubuntu community team have announced a new initiative. Oh, I'm crackling.
New initiative?
Are you sure it's not your beard?
It's definitely not my beard this time. Okay. It's definitely some sort of audio glitch.
Okay.
A new initiative called Ubuntu Pioneers. And they said they want to celebrate the first 200 app developers who get their apps in Ubuntu, says Michael Hall. There's a new Pioneers website and there are t-shirts up for grabs.
This sounds very exciting.
So these are like the apps that you'd get on Ubuntu phone and tablets.
Yeah.
The first 200 developers who create those apps go in this Pioneers page, which will become frozen once we hit 200.
And it'll be on the internet forever and nobody can ask to be erased.
You cannot get it removed, yes.
Take that, God of justice.
it's a big list and it lists all the applications that each of those people have developed. It's quite cool. It's a nice way to say thank you, to say, look, these are the people who stepped up early on in the project and developed apps before we even had a hardware device, before we had deals with companies who make handsets, before we had deals with carriers. These are people who started maybe 6 months or a year ago started developing these apps.
So these will be the first 200 developers.
Yep.
So after then, if they then develop, if the same people develop more apps after these first 200 have been done, do they new apps get added to this list to say
no? I think we're going to freeze it once it hits 200. Right. I think what we'll just do is freeze the page as it is, make it a static page, job done.
They've only got 200 t-shirts.
Yeah, but I mean, because if you could have 200 app developers, but they could have five apps each, so if one of them does a sixth app,
to be honest, that's not
That's not the most important thing. The thing is, it's to try and give recognition to the people who actually gave their time to create apps before we've even got the ability to sell apps. So there's no way to make money from these right now. It's people are creating free software for a platform that isn't available in shops, and we thought we'd give a bit of recognition. So that's what Pioneers is all about.
Sounds a bit like the Hall of Fame idea that there was.
Yeah, but the Hall of Fame was one person at a time and took a lot of admin. This is, 200 people. Once it's done, freeze it, and we don't have to maintain it. That's epic gonna, win for everyone.
You could always PDF the page.
Yeah, exactly. It will print it out.
Yeah. Put it on the Ubuntu fridge.
Yes. Friend of the show, Mark Shuttleworth, has delivered his keynote address at the OpenStack Summit, during which he revealed the world's fastest supercomputer runs on Ubuntu. Ooh. And a bunch of other stuff as well.
Ooh.
Yes. It's quite interesting. He always, whenever he does his keynotes, he tries, especially at OpenStack, he tries to give a live demo. Well, I don't say try to give; he gives a live demo, and he has the demo gods on his side, and invariably they work really well.
Cool.
Needed it again. We'll put a link to the video in the show notes. It's quite interesting to watch.
Somebody did say, you know, he's a very confident man. He builds a cluster live on stage. Very few CEOs would step up and do that. Not that he's CEO. He's obviously, you know, above that.
Yeah.
But yeah, very few people would set up. And I don't want to do Jane a disservice. But yeah, you know, very few people would step up and do that and have the technical chops to do it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, giving a presentation. There's obviously a bit of sales pitch, a bit of marketing in there, but also, you know, he's a geek at heart. You know, he's got a garage full of servers just like the rest of us. So, you know, it's, I think he relishes in giving a live demo and showing that the product actually works.
I bet he's got a double garage, isn't he?
I don't know.
I bet. there's been an interesting blog post written by Bob, who has done some analysis on the errors.ubuntu.com website, which is where the automated crash reports get sent.
They optionally get sent there.
If an application crashes, you get the option to send a crash report. If you do, it will go onto this website in due course, and you can see interesting graphs about stats and things, and you can see the cycle of crash reports change as a new release is brought out and people upgrade to it and therefore stop getting crash reports on the old version.
Oh.
And things like that. It's quite an interesting little analysis that's gone on there.
Yeah, he's picked out some bits of data about certain points in the life cycle of a release, and how, you know, where the peaks and troughs are, and yeah, it's worth a look.
Yeah, basically there's a huge number of crash reports from the days immediately after a release, so 2 or 3 days after release. Yeah, and then it drops smoothly off over time, presumably because people are actually releasing fixes for these bugs.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can speculate about, you know, why they drop off, and actually there is obviously data behind this. You can go and pick on each individual error and go and find the bug behind it. It links to the bug behind it, and then from that you can find the merge request that fixed it and when it landed. So you can say, well, that one tailed off on this day because that's when it landed in the store, but then in the software center or in the repository. But then, you know, how often do people update their machines, and are they updating? And, you know, you probably see it trail off a bit, but then a couple of peaks when there are people who update their machines a bit later, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of speculation about,
stuff.
Yes, the theory behind why the peak and trough at various times. And yeah, you could probably have a full-time job figuring that out.
Cool.
So the desktop team have proposed adding a new flavor of Ubuntu so that they can test out the Unity 8 desktop, or people can try out the Unity 8 desktop.
Yeah, they want to have an official flavor, a Unity 8 flavor.
Ooh.
So rather, at the moment, obviously the default Ubuntu desktop is Unity 7, which is the one that you've got on your 1204, 1210, 1310, you know, 1404. But on the phone, we use Unity 8, phone and tablets, Unity 8.
Right, yeah.
And the view is, in the future, that will be the default desktop. And so what they wanted to do is have an ISO image that you can test that out and test out apps on that, cool, without having the other desktops around or any other you know, stuff.
Well, that sounds really good.
It was only proposed today, so yeah, that should happen soon.
You heard it here first.
Well, yes, unless you read the new mailing list, in which case you heard it earlier.
And finally, Canonical will be demonstrating Ubuntu Touch at Mobile Asia Expo on the 11th to 13th of June. So if you're in the area, presumably that means in Asia somewhere,
area,
why not pop along?
If you're mobile in Asia, go along to the Mobile Asia Expo.
Yes.
I guess it sounds like fun.
That's the end of the news. Where did the time go? That's all for episode 7. We'll be back next week when we'll be talking to Graham Morrison about Linux Voice and the new Linux magazine, which was crowdfunded at the end of last year.
Yeah, so if you're listening live, stay tuned because you're going to be able to hear that now. But if you're downloading, come back next week. We do make these things easy for ourselves, don't we? Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Goodbye. Bye.